From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 25th day of June 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Mike Zuzolo of Global Commodity Analytics in Lafayette, Indiana. And then later in the half hour, we'll discuss cash grain market with Bruce Bostert. He's the manager of the Ludlow Co-op Elevator Company out of Ludlow, Illinois. In agricultural news, U.S. exports of poultry to Russia are set to resume. Lawmakers have decided it's okay for banks to trade some over-the-counter derivatives. And Senator Max Baucus plans to reintroduce a bill targeting currency manipulation. Dave Dickey will be here with the details. Don't forget that we're in the middle of our end-of-the-year fund drive, and if you have the opportunity, you can always visit willag.org and pledge your financial support, or just dial in at 217-244-9455 by June the 30th, and thank you so much in advance. Speaking of in advance, in the second half hour of our program today, we call that the Farming World. We'll hear again a story we did last week with the National Renewable Energy Lab on wind energy. You asked to hear it again, and we'll provide that today. And Lisa Braltz will be here, as always, on a Friday afternoon for In My Backyard. And it all happens right here on this edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media.
This stock and commodity report on Illinois Public Media is made possible with support from Bates Commodities in Normal, providing clients with the latest market information based on research by ADM Investor Services and other independent sources. Bates Commodities can be reached at 1-800-383-4647 or on the internet at batescom.net.
In Chicago on this Friday afternoon, futures finish the day like this. The nearby soft red winter wheat in the July contract at 456 and a quarter, down 6 3/4. September at 471, 6.5 cents lower, and December at 497.5, down 6 3/4. July corn futures 340.5, down 4 1/4. September 349.5, down 4 1/4. And December futures at 360.5, down 4 cents on the day. March contract 373.5, down 4 in the corn pit. Soybeans July 957, 1.5 cents higher. August at 941, up 1 1/4. September at 921, 3/4 higher. And November at $9.12, unchanged on the day. July bean meal at 289.60, 50 lower. July oil down 1 cent at 37.16. June live cattle $90.95, up 30. August feeders at 113.20, up 52.5 cents. And the July lean hogs at $80.72.5, 65 cents higher. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. Crude oil futures nearby August contract, $78.90 a barrel, up $2.39. Ethanol at $1.53 6/10, that's down 1 1/8 cents. Natural gas at $4.88 6/10, 13 8/10 higher on the day. Diesel fuel or heating oil at $2.11 1/10 cent. 5 3/10 cents higher, and the gold futures on the afternoon at $1,255.80. The settlement price there up $10.30 an ounce. The Dow Jones Industrial Average at 10,186 is up just about 34 points, and the U.S. dollar at 85.32 is down 0.41 on the afternoon. Here's what the weather forecast is calling for across the Midwest. Should be drier, and that should continue into many of the areas today with some warming temperatures, warm and humid weather during the weekend. That'll be accompanied by some thunderstorms eventually. Most of next week, though, will be dry. Temperatures will trend cooler for a little while early next week. And warming weather will continue into the following weekend. Topsoil conditions will trend to be a bit firmer, but crop development will continue to be hastened by standing water in some of those fields until they get dried out. We'll take a more complete look at the weather forecast when we get to the bottom of the hour and talk with Steve Hilberg of NOAA's Midwestern Regional Climate Center here on the Closing Market Report. If you haven't dialed in yet with your pledge of financial support, by the way, please do that. The number is 217-244-9455, or just visit our website at willag.org and hit the big red button up in the right-hand side of the corner. Make sure you check Ag or tell them Ag, one of the two, and pledge your financial support today. Thank you so much in advance. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. It is the 25th day of June, 2010.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Rob Meyerhofer in Morris at 815-941-3708. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Mike Zuzlo of Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting is on the phone line with us this afternoon to take a look at the futures markets. Good afternoon to you, Mike.
Hey, good afternoon, Todd.
Busy week here as we're fundraising for our end-of-the-year goals. You know, Illinois Public Media, of course, is a cooperative effort between the University of Illinois, U of I Extension, the radio station here, the public radio station, and the commercial radio stations that this program airs on. And you, the listening audience, and if we're doing things right, your job is, well, to visit willag.org and pledge your financial support, or to dial in at 217-244-9455. We'll get back to that in a moment, but let's talk now with Mike Zuzlo of GCAC. Mike, thanks for being with us. Tell me what you saw in the marketplace today, and then take a look forward at those USDA reports.
Well, I think the continuation of the weaker feed grains market today was what we had to deal with coming off of last Friday's weakness, Todd. It sure seemed like to me that we lost some technical foothold on Friday afternoon of last week, disappointing in the corn trade and somewhat disappointing in the wheat trade. This week in wheat, where it was a leader to the upside last week, it seemed to shift gears where Canada's wetness and planting problems were such a focus last week. We did see harvest start in Kansas, and we started to see the hard red market start to feel a lot more harvest pressure. And the trade kind of shifted gears, and we saw that especially today when the Kansas City pressured the Chicago all day long, made new lows into the close. So corn had it on both ends. It had a technical rough start to the week after last week's trade. We had the EPA decision to push out the ethanol blend decision and increase potential. And we also lost our leader to the upside, the wheat market. So we kind of had a continuation, whereas the beans, it seemed like until yesterday's close, the beans had a real strong week because the trade in Chicago, I think, generally speaking, respects the bean weather a lot more than the corn weather. I think, generally speaking, the traders I've talked to believe that the corn crop is made. They hear tassels are shooting. They aren't worried as much about the standing water. They aren't worried as much about the yield potential loss because of, you know, denitrification. But they see the ponds and the beans. They know bean acres didn't get planted. So they've been more respectful of the beans. And you add on top of that the continuation of a very strong July-November bean spread. We hit 3 to 4 week highs late here in the week with between the July running up against the November. So had almost a continuation of last week's trade all the way through this week.
Let me say here that just because you can see the water in the rows and the soybeans doesn't mean it's not there in the corn bed, but I suppose that's up to the traders, and they think that that corn crop is made. We'll find out when we get to the yield time whether it is or not. I suspect there will be some acres that are pretty rough on their yield, but I won't make any notions about that. I did want to go back to the wheat very quickly because of the delivery situation. Is that having an impact on current price, do you think, and price out into July of next year too?
Yeah, it sure is, and I think you're going to find. I think in the next 2 weeks, because I'm getting some early yield reports from clients over in Ohio that are able to get into the fields and combine and cut soft red wheat, mixed yield results, and a lot of aflatoxin. And so I think the soft red market could actually divorce itself from the hard red market, where the soft red futures gains premium against the hard red because the yields seem to be more there for the hard red. And because of the basis and that delivery issue that you're talking about is not as prominent in the hard red. It's much more prominent in the soft red. So other than the aflatoxin issue, I think the soft red is setting itself up to find a very nice base here in the next week and a half. I have a hard time thinking that the Chicago wheat is going to continue to follow the hard red wheat lower, especially after the grain stocks report are unknown and the acreage numbers are in known as well, you know, after the middle part of next week.
Okay, tell me about those USDA reports, because on the 30th day of June, we'll get the grain stocks report and we'll get that acreage report. You think we'll see anything interesting?
I think we'll have to, because the way the trade's set up, the number that came out this afternoon with the corn stocks was the largest. I went back and looked, and it surpasses where we were in June 1 of 08. It surpasses where we were in June 1 of 07. Based upon my calculations, the average guess of 4.6 billion bushels for June 1 corn takes us all the way back to the June of 1987 when we had 5.84 billion bushels. So the trade has set us up for a very bearish report. In fact, we made new weekly lows today, I think not just because of the wheat, but also in the July corn off of these being released before the close, Todd. And I think the beans are almost the exact opposite. I referenced that July no bean spread. I think we're setting ourselves up for a very bullish number in the stocks report for beans. The average trade guess, just under 595 million bushels. That would be right around where we were last year at this time when it came in at 596. Other than that, the lowest number we have had is back in 2003 on June 1 of 410 million bushels. So I think the trade is walking into this report bearish old crop corn, bearish new crop corn, bullish old crop beans, and bullish new crop beans for the most part.
And then bringing you back to the soft red winter wheat, because you talked about it setting sort of a base and a bottom, not enough to pull corn up if it starts to rally?
Well, I think if Kansas City keeps going lower, it's going to be hard for the Chicago to rally. I think we would need the average trade guess on the stocks report is 940 million bushels. The lowest number is 929. The highest is 950. So we've got a very tight range. What I'd like to see is us come in below that 929, that low number. And I think that would set the trade up with the idea, okay, we've punished the wheat enough. Yield reports aren't that great, and we already know acres are already low, and they've probably been damaged by all the wetness, and we probably got some disease in the soft red. Let's be careful not to oversell, you know, this 900-some million bushels that we have of old crop, because we're going to be extremely tight a year from now. And I hope that type of psychology takes hold, because the report gives us that opportunity.
The quarterly hogs and pigs report was released at 2 o'clock this afternoon. It showed all hogs and pigs on June 1 at 96, kept for breeding at 97, kept for marketing at 96, March and May pig crop at 97. Those were all within the range, the March-May pigs per litter at 102%. Anything in those numbers that seemed out of ordinary to you and that gives you any idea of what domestic usage per feed and residual might be?
Well, we're gonna increase the herd, but it's probably not going to come until the early 2011 time period, because the June to no farrowings came in at 99%. That's where your expansion really comes in. Until then, you're going to have pretty tight numbers until early 2011. The only thing I would say is the kept for marketing number came in at 96.3, and I show the lowest number is 96.5. That might help your summer markets, your August, your July futures, maintain some premium. They've been hit extra hard here the last couple weeks, and it seems like the bear spread has been really active in the July and the August hogs. They've been selling July and August, buying the fall markets. I wonder if the kept for breeding and the marketing number may not reverse that trend, so that's what I'll be looking for next week.
Can we finish up with the outside markets? Talk to me about this little rally in the oil for the day, up $2.50 or thereabouts, in crude oil, and then the Dow is up 18 points, but it's not too far above 10,000.
No, you know, we've actually found some stability here. I noticed that the commercial paper market was the best it's been. 3 weeks in a row, we've had an increase in the commercial paper market. That's where companies go out and borrow short-term money. That's what seized up and locked up when we had the financial crisis. It's coming back very nicely. And so we have this G20 meeting coming up this weekend. I think that's probably why the dollar's a little bit weaker and the stocks are a little bit firmer, because they haven't seen any follow-through selling. We also had the financial regulation and reform bill get through committee, and looks like it's going to get passed in the Senate and the House this week. So far, the banks are rallying off of this news, not going down. I think that's something to watch. As far as the energies, there's a tropical wave in the right off the Yucatan in Central America. It looks like it might become a top tropical depression as early as tomorrow. The energy traders are very nervous about that, and they're buying it up because of what's going on with the Gulf oil spill and the fact that we'll probably shut in a lot of energy if we have any kind of disturbances out there at all.
Thank you so much.
Hey, thanks, Todd, and good luck with the fund drive.
All right, thank you. That's Mike Zuzulo. He's with Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting out of Lafayette, Indiana. Joins us here on the Closing Mark Report on a Friday afternoon. If you get the opportunity, do visit willag.org, pledge your financial support, or call this number, 217-244-9455.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a Friday afternoon. My friend and partner in studio with me today, Dave Dickey, Director of Agricultural Programming for Illinois Public Media, to talk to us about some of the reasons that you, the listener to Ag Programming, might want to pledge your financial support to us as we finish up our fiscal year. We do have to put all the money in the bank that we'll be using next year, not for this year, but the next fiscal year, which starts July 1 by the end of this month, by June the 30th. That's USDA Report Day. It's an important day here, too, because all that money needs to be in the bank, and that's the only money that, well, we use to operate Illinois Public Media and the Ag Programming, Dave Dickey, and we want people to call 217-244-9455 right now if they can, or visit willag.org if you're listening online in some form. And up at the top of the page, that little red button, click on it, and either way, make sure that you either check Ag or tell them Ag, and that's what you're supporting with your financial dollars today. Right, Dave?
Indeed, that is right, Todd. And as Mike Zuzulo was going through the analysis with you, I was reflecting on the fact that we have about 21 different analysts that we hear from each and every week on willag.org and Illinois Public Media. So you get a wide range of opinions about the marketplace, about the futures market, about the basis, about the cash, about the agricultural weather. And in all of that, it allows you the ability to sort of make up your mind and make your best decisions about your marketing in a way that will improve, we hope, your back pocket and make it a little bit heavier. When we take all that information and we deliver it to you other ways as well, weekly Ag e-letter, if you're on that page at willag.org right now, over in the right margin, you can click on a link and subscribe to that. But go and click on that big red button and subscribe to our service through willag.org. $100 pledge is what we generally recommend. We think that's a fair amount of money. 217-244-9455, accept Visa, MasterCard, American Express, or Discover Card, or at willag.org as well, Todd.
Thank you much. Now Dave is back, and he'll bring us all the ag news for the afternoon, too.
In agricultural news, the U.S. and Russia have reached an agreement that will allow the U.S. to resume exporting chicken to Russia. The deal assures Russia that U.S. chicken exports will not go through a chlorinated water rinse. Instead, U.S. negotiators agreed that three alternative sanitizing compounds will be used. Russia effectively banned U.S. chicken on January 1st by prohibiting importation of poultry that is processed with chlorinated rinses. U.S. lawmakers finalizing sweeping financial reforms agreed today to allow banks to trade in-house many types of over-the-counter derivatives, watering down a controversial plan that would have required banks to spin off much of their lucrative swaps dealing desks. Under the deal, banks can trade in-house foreign exchange and interest rate swaps, gold and silver swaps, and derivatives designed to hedge their own risk. But banks will need to spin off dealing desks to affiliates to handle agricultural, energy, and metal swaps, equity swaps, and uncleared credit default swaps. A landmark trade deal between Taiwan and China will cut tariffs on more than 800 products and open up service industries, giving a major boost to around $100 billion in annual two-way trade. The most significant deal between the former political foes in 60 years will be signed on June 29th. The cuts on the Taiwan items are valued at $13.84 billion and those from China, $2.86 billion. Senate Finance Committee Chairman Max Baucus says he plans to reintroduce a bill targeting currency manipulation. Baucus also told Commerce Secretary Gary Locke that Commerce must carefully consider whether China's currency practices constitute an improper subsidy under U.S. countervailing duty law. China last Saturday announced it was easing its currency peg to the dollar to allow more flexibility. However, China appears to be controlling the price movement of its currency to such a degree that senators, including Baucus, are prepared to continue their efforts to pressure China via new U.S. laws. And that's a look at today's agricultural news.
Support for agricultural programming comes from the Westchester Group, an agricultural asset management firm specializing in land auctions for farmland, timberland, and recreational land. More information on upcoming auctions is at westchester-auctions.com or at 800-607-6888.
You're listening to the Closing Mark Report on a Friday afternoon. Time to check in on the cash grain market. And Bruce Bostard is away today. Matt Payne of the Andersons right here in Champaign County is with us to do that. Thanks, Matt, for joining us this afternoon.
No problem.
Cash grain movement at all in your area?
We've had a little bit of people before this report on Wednesday kind of finishing up some old crop sales. Other than that, it's been a little bit slow. I am starting to see some first signs of wheat harvest, though, so that's good.
And tell me a little bit more about that. There's probably not much wheat around. Is it any good?
What we've been getting first has been from Terre Haute, Indiana area, and it's been quality hasn't been quite as good as we'd like. All this heavy rain, it's been kind of hard on wheat, but yield producers have been telling us between 80 and 90 on yield, so not too shabby considering.
All right, and then back to things at hand, and look at this USDA report. When you look at the numbers for quarterly grain stocks in particular, does that number bother you? It looks like it may be a 4 or 5.55 or a 5 billion or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I am concerned just looking at quality, and we know how much carryout we're going to kind of have. I'm definitely concerned, but for once, I'm going to say I'm a little bit more optimistic on the beans. I've been negative beans for so long, I'm feeling a little bit more positive just because of we didn't quite get as much planted acres as we thought we would.
Okay, and your bids for the day, if you have them in front of you?
Yeah, July corn were 330, August 334, and fall 330. On the bean side, we're 962. Fall delivery, 877, DC 877, and for wheat delivery, we're 446.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Matt Payne is with the Andersons right here in Champaign County. Usually they join us on a Monday afternoon, filling in for Bruce Bostard this afternoon of the Ludlow Co-op Elevator Company. In just a couple of minutes, we'll take a complete look at the agricultural weather forecast. Drew Lerner of World Weather Incorporated usually joins us, not today, so but Steve Hilberg today. From the Midwestern Regional Climate Center right here in Champaign County will be with us. You are, of course, listening to the Closing Mark Report. This is a production of Illinois Public Media from the University of Illinois. Hey, have you dialed in your supportive financial support to us yet? If you have not, please take time right now to do that. The number to call is 217-244-9455, or visit us online. The ag site is willag.org, and then up on the top side of the page, you'll see a big red button. And if you push that, you'll get to a way to pledge your financial support in a secure online site, Visa, MasterCard, Discover, and American Express, either at willag.org. Press the red button or dial this number, 217-244-9455. Dave Dickey and I like to have you pledge around $120. But the important thing is that you pledge today, because by June the 30th, 30th, Dave Dickey, we need all the money in the bank that we'll be using next year.
Indeed we do, and we got about $180,000 to go. That's the big number. The little number, though, is one, as in one phone call at a time. Some people to thank who have already contributed this afternoon on this closing market report, including Tricia Crowder, Steve Stairwalt, and Stephen Brown. Thank you all three for their contributions this afternoon. You can be the next at 217-244-9455 or go to willag.org and click on that big red button. If you do, either way, phone or web, let the people know that you're contributing to the agricultural services, and we thank you for that. If you give the $100 level or higher, we'll hand you one of these nifty hats that I'm wearing right now, one just like it. The last thing I do before I go in the studio every day is I throw this hat on, and it's my lucky hat, and you can get one just like it for a $100 pledge at 217-244-9455. Or willag.org and click on that big red button, Todd.
You bet. 217-244-9455 or willag.org. It is a Friday afternoon. Steve Hilberg, the director of the Midwestern Regional Climate Center that belongs to NOAA, is with us to talk about the agricultural weather forecast today. Hi, Steve. How are you today?
Hi, Todd. Doing fine.
Well, tell me that the water is going to dry up for a while.
I think so. I think we're going to get some good drying in here over the next week to 10 days. One little fly in the ointment will be a cold front, but that's actually good. Coming through here late this weekend, that will probably bring us some showers and thunderstorms. Not the amount of rain that we, of course, saw in the last week to 10 days, but enough to keep things a little damp. But after that goes through, we're going to be in a period of cooler and drier weather for much of next week. Looks like it will start to warm up toward the 4th of July weekend, but not exceptionally so right now. So I think with that in place, we should see some good evaporation rates and hopefully seeing a lot of these fields start to dry out.
How wet are we?
Oh, we're wet. Most of central Illinois, central and northern Illinois, are already at twice the normal June rainfall. Rainfall amounts, for example, across Champaign County here range anywhere from about 8 to 10 to 11 inches for the month of June. The only areas of the state that really didn't pick up as much is as far as southern Illinois, and they actually could use a little bit of rain down there. But they're closer to normal than anybody else. But basically north of I-64, it's been a very wet June.
Farmers will be very concerned, and others, that they haven't been able to get in and put herbicide on, some even some nitrogen application. Could you take a look and make a guess at how quickly these soils might firm up enough to run a buggy across them?
Well, a lot of it really depends. It's really going to be hard to say. I think next week we'll see a huge improvement, especially in where there wasn't any real ponding. I've seen a lot of ponding around Champaign County here, and I imagine that's the case. And there's probably stuff we can't even see because the corn's so high right now that's out in the field. But in general, I think next week, after Sunday, we should see some rapid improvement in the condition of the soils. And like I said, even Sunday's rainfall does not look as widespread nor as heavy as we experienced the last week or so. So even that shouldn't be a huge deterrent. And I would imagine by the middle of next week, those soils that weren't actually saturated with water standing on them should be and starting to show some significant improvement.
Okay, Steve, thanks so much for taking the time with us today.
All right, Todd.
Steve Hilberg is the director of the Midwestern Regional Climate Center. It belongs to NOAA right here in Urbana-Champaign. If you have not dialed this number yet, please do so. It's 217-244-9455 with your pledge of financial support for the agricultural programming at Illinois Public Media. If you're online, you can always go to willag.org and hit that big red button that's up on the right-hand side of the page. It is important, though, Dave Dickey, that they make that pledge today. We're in the throes of the end of our fiscal year, and by Wednesday of next week, we have to have everything in the bank that we're going to operate on.
It's last chance Texaco, actually, Todd, for the being able to pledge for this particular program. It went away in a blink. It was there today, and it's gone today. And 217-244-945. Don't be late.
Yeah, that's right. 217-244-9455. And willag.org either way. Coming up, a rerun from last week because you asked for it. You wanted to know more about wind energy, and I got a lot of questions about it after we ran this piece. So Fort Felker will be here from the National Renewable Energy Lab one more time. This is The Farming World. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Fort Felker is here. He's the director of National Wind Technology Center in Colorado. Joins us to talk about wind energy. Mr. Felker, thanks so much for being with us today.
You're most welcome. It's a pleasure to be here.
Tell me about the National Wind Technology Center. What is it?
The National Wind Technology Center is a part of the National Renewable Energy Lab, which is the nation's only research and development lab that's focused exclusively on renewable energy. We get the vast predominance of our funding from the U.S. Department of Energy. The National Wind Technology Center is a part of NREL, and we lead the nation's wind research and development effort. We've been at it for about 35 years.
What kinds of research do you do?
Well, we initially started out testing wind turbines. This was back in the mid-70s when wind turbines were not the mature technology that is in place today. At the time, really very little was known about wind turbines and the way they respond to turbulence in the atmosphere. And so we started off exclusively with a testing program. And as the years have gone by, that has expanded into analysis work and supporting deployment and looking at systems integration issues of getting the wind turbines onto the grid, environmental issues, and at this point we have a fairly comprehensive research program that's intended to lead to greater wind deployment in the United States.
Here in the Midwest, in the state of Illinois in particular, we're fairly familiar with wind turbines, many of them in the area and to the north of us. In fact, a wind farm, I think, being discussed for our immediate area. Why don't you talk a bit about the environmental impacts?
Well, there was very little understood in the early days about how wind turbines interact with the environment. There were some early surprises about adverse interactions between wind turbines and birds. There have been subsequent research done that has demonstrated that you have to be cognizant of the local environment and how you site the wind turbines, not just in terms of impacts on birds, but also bats, and then also wildlife that nests or makes their habitat in the ground. Sometimes the wind turbines create a visual situation that deters them from pursuing their traditional nesting approach, and that's true of the sage grouse. And other times, just having maybe access roads that lead from one turbine to another for maintenance purposes creates habitat fragmentation. So it's really been a lot to learn about how wind turbines interact in the environment and how to site the wind plants to minimize those impacts. One of the key approaches that's been developed here at the National Renewable Energy Lab is to partner with the environmental specialists, the Audubon Society, the Wilderness Fund, the organizations that really take as their mission for protecting wildlife. Let's get everybody at the table, including those organizations, and try to do scientific work that leads to good guidance on where to put wind plants and where not to put them.
Have you been able to do any scientific work on birds and migration patterns and the impact and how to limit the impact of a wind farm?
Well, you hit the nail on the head there with migration patterns. So it's very important to understand where those migration patterns are. We're learning to use already in place radar assets to understand where the birds migrate, and to be sure that you don't put a wind plant right in the middle of their migratory path. You know, put it someplace else where the migratory path will not interfere or pass through the wind plant.
What does our past experience tell us about those migratory paths and if a wind plant is in their way?
Well, we're learning a lot about where those migratory paths are, and so I think quite a bit of data has been acquired over the last few decades due to a sustained interaction with the environmental community about what's a good place to put the wind plant and what isn't. And what's happening is, of course, as wind continues to be widely deployed, particularly in the Midwest, is that this is just going to become a bigger and bigger issue as all the obviously great sites are developed first, and so you then have to be faced with greater challenges as you continue to expand the scope of the wind deployment.
Is there any indication that migratory birds will learn about a wind farm and avoid it?
Well, they absolutely do. There's been some fantastic radar work done on an offshore wind plant in Europe, just off the coast of Denmark, where they've got some very detailed tracks of birds. And it's remarkable how you can see the birds flying around the wind plant entirely, most of them. And the ones that don't fly around the wind plant, you can see them, the path going between the rows of the wind turbines. So they definitely know they're there, and they definitely avoid them. Some of the earlier adverse experience was acquired with the much smaller wind turbines that were deployed in the 70s and 80s. Small machines, maybe a tenth of the size of the modern machines. Those early small machines had a much higher rotor RPM, much higher rotation rate, that makes it difficult to see the blades. It was like a propeller where you don't see the blades. It's turning so fast. The modern giant machines that you see in the Midwest now, the rotational speed is so much slower that it's much easier for wildlife to see and avoid the turning rotor.
How tall are most of those turbines?
A typical turbine today would be on top of a tower that was somewhere between 250 and 300 feet tall, and the rotor diameter would be similar, somewhere in the 250 to 350 foot range for the rotor diameter. So between the tower and the rotor, get pretty close to 500 feet.
And so are there success stories and non-success stories in that range? And I guess that's 80 to 100 meters, actually a little above that sometimes. And what's the difference between having something closer to the ground and something that's much further up?
Well, one of the reasons why you're seeing wind turbines deployed on taller and taller towers is, of course, the wind blows harder at altitude than it does down at ground level. And so by installing the wind turbine on top of a tall tower, you're getting up into an environment where the wind is blowing stronger and there's more energy to capture. So it makes the energy produced by a given turbine is increased when you go on top of a tall tower. And that's the reason you're seeing that trend, and that trend is going to continue.
And what do you know about wind patterns in the Midwest? And have you been able to map them all around the nation? And are there corridors that are better for wind farm plants than others?
Yes, absolutely. And NREL has been working for years to provide nationwide and state-by-state wind resource maps. Those are all available at our website, www.nrel.gov. So go to that site, and you'll be able to find the wind resource maps both for Illinois and for the whole nation. The Midwest of the United States has just got a fantastic wind resource. There's enough wind there to power the entire nation. T. Boone Pickens coined a great phrase that I think really illustrates it. He calls it the Saudi Arabia of wind, and it's true.
Well, we'll find out. But the other question is, how long do these can these plants operate? And then what happens to them when we're done? Are the turbines recyclable? Have you done work with what to do with the wind farm at the end of its working life?
Most wind plants are designed for a working life of 20 years. I can tell you, though, there are wind turbines that were installed in some of the early deployments in California in the 70s and 80s. They're still on the job producing power. So the design life and the actual life are two different matters. Through careful maintenance and component replacements as they wear out, it's possible to keep the machines operating well beyond the design life of 20 years. In terms of recycling, the main components in the turbines are either steel, for example, the tower, which is easy to recycle, concrete, which is in the foundations. You might just leave those in the ground, or, of course, concrete can always be ground up and used for aggregate for new concrete or new roads or new buildings. And then the blades are fiberglass, and I think probably that's the biggest challenge is how to recycle the blades. I don't think that problem has been solved yet.
How much more efficient are the turbines today than they were in the 60s and the 70s when the California wind farms were put into place?
It's been about a factor of 10 in terms of the reduction in cost of energy. The initial deployments in the 60s, 70s were fairly expensive. The cost of energy was on the order of 40 to 50 cents per kilowatt hour, so much, much higher than fossil fuel base of power. Today, wind turbines are generating power for on the order of 4 or 5 cents a kilowatt hour, which makes them absolutely competitive with fossil fuels such as coal or natural gas. So it's been tremendous progress been made.
Are they truly a good answer for our energy needs as it comes to electricity?
Well, one thing that makes wind turbines especially good match for the needs of the United States, and I know that the farm community will appreciate this, is wind turbines not only produce energy at low costs, but of all the forms of generating electricity, they use the least water. People don't widely appreciate just how much water is used in a conventional fossil fuel plant or even a nuclear plant where water is used for cooling. Wind turbines use absolutely zero water at all, and this is becoming more and more of an issue as the demands on fresh water in the nation increase and the supply is beginning to diminish as a result of climate change.
How hard is it to integrate them into the system so that they put themselves into the electrical grid?
The main constraint is the availability of transmission. Most places where it's really windy, not many people live there. It's just not a pleasant place to live where it's really windy, and so you end up having the turbines remote from where the demand for the electricity is. So the demand for the electricity is in the cities, think in terms of Chicago, and the where the wind is generated is out in the country. So you need to have transmission to move that power from where the wind blows to where the consumption is. And the United States really has not been investing in its transmission system for the last 20 years or so. The system was overbuilt initially, and we've been sort of living off that excess capacity for quite some time as the demand for electricity has gone up and up and up and up in the country. And we're at the situation now where the system really is running at capacity, and so to move power around, we're going to have to invest in more transmission.
Beyond the things that we've discussed already, as far as downfalls potentially of the system, migratory patterns of birds, some of the environmental issues, what are the problems with wind turbines?
Some of the areas that we're focused on in terms of our research and development program here at the National Wind Technology Center are attempting to further improve the cost competitiveness of wind so that not only competes with fossil-based fuels, but in fact, our goal is to make it less expensive, so it'll be the cheapest electricity source. Turbines that are in the field today are sometimes not as reliable as we would like. They have an intended 20-year lifetime, but some machines are having problems before then, so we have a very strong research program addressed at improving the overall turbine reliability. And so those are really our focuses, is to improve reliability, get the cost down, and increase the energy capture.
Fort Felker is director of the National Wind Technology Center at the National Renewable Energy Lab. They're all located in Colorado. You've been listening to The Farming World on this Friday afternoon. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. If you have comments or questions or suggestions for our program, please don't hesitate to give us a call or write us an email. The phone number to call is 217-333-1070. That's 217-333-1070. Or you can write Dave Dickey and I at one time. It's one email, but goes to both of us. It's at willagstaff@illinois.edu. That's willagstaff@illinois.edu. We'll return in just a couple of minutes and talk with Lisa Braltz.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated, headquartered in Lafayette, Indiana, with branches in Chalmers, Indiana, and Hudsonville, Illinois, providing independent commodity, financial, and currency analysis to its clients and newsletter subscribers. On the web at myrmconline.com.
Hey, have you dialed in yet? If not, with your pledge of financial support to Illinois Public Media and the agricultural programming, Dave Dickey and I sure do hope you will do that right now at 217-244-9455. That's another number to remember, but it's the important one on the afternoon, 217-244-9455. Dave's got some folks that dialed in, pledged online with us too, probably, to thank yet this afternoon. Thanks for being back in studio.
I indeed do, Todd. A couple of people to thank. One to thank Mr. Randy Pithoud, and I also want to thank Stephen and Kathina Fay, who both dialed in this afternoon with their pledge of financial support. It is now last chance, Texaco, for the closing market report. Your chance to call 217-244-9455 or at willag.org. Click on the big red button in the upper right-hand corner of the window. Pledge your support for agriculture when you see it up there, and just check on that one, and we'll do all the rest for you. And I'll thank you with a hat if you give it the $100 level, Todd. By the way, I designed this hat.
It's a cool-looking hat.
I am proud of this hat.
I know you are.
It's my lucky hat. I wear it when I do broadcasting. You can be just like Dave. Be like Dave, 217-244-9455, or at willag.org.
Yeah, and when you go to willag.org, just hit that button up at the top of the page. It's a great big red button. Willag.org if you're listening online, or 217-244-9455. Actually, you can do that 24 hours a day. Just make sure you tell them agriculture.
Hi, this is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. Coming up next, squash, tomatoes, beans, lettuce, onions. These are among the staples of the Midwestern backyard garden. But some Urbana residents are growing something just a little bit unusual. Lisa Brautz has a story in this week's edition of In My Backyard.
I'm sure many of you will agree. There are few things finer, really, than spending an afternoon doing battle with weeds in the garden on a hot, sunny day, followed by stretching out in a chair and opening an ice-cold beer. One thing that interests me about beer, besides the fact that it's beer, is that we so often forget it's an agricultural product, that it's made from grains and plants. Some people do like to brew for themselves and their friends, and it's gotten easier to do, thanks to home brewing kits that are relatively easy to find at brew shops or on the internet. But what about using local ingredients in this process? Brewing beer relies heavily on grains like malted barley and wheat for its substance and its strength. Neither of these grains are something you see growing amongst the tomatoes found in a home garden. However, part of brewing also involves hops, a vigorous perennial vine showcasing extremely cute little cones of flavor that make beer taste really, really good. A person could grow a few vines with very little trouble. But why would anyone want to, you might ask? I don't brew my own beer. I don't even drink beer. Well, neither does Jill Miller, one of my neighbors. But she grows hops. She loves hops. And it has nothing to do with their role in brewing beer.
I really have no interest in brewing beer, but there are enough people in the neighborhood that if they want my hops, they can have it. Otherwise, it's just decorative.
In addition to supplying neighborhood brewers with hops, Jill has other reasons for wanting to raise them.
You're supposed to sort of leave them alone for the first year, and then this spring, it was just so warm, they just popped right up and spread all over, and now they're like a weed, which is what they do. They grow so fast. I love it. And I wanted more shade. We don't really have backyard tree or anything, and so I'm hoping to get a trellis and train them to grow over in the future.
Hops are resource hungry. They require a lot of sun, water, nutrients, and well-drained soil, so they grow well here in central Illinois. They've been grown in southern Wisconsin and upstate New York commercially, but nowadays most domestic hops are grown in the Pacific Northwest, and brewers are starting to take an interest in locally grown organic hops for their operations.
There's some pretty good research being done at Washington State University, and they're interested in the organic side of the hop production. And right now, most organic hops are sourced from both New Zealand and Germany, so they're traveling a long distance. And I know Anheuser-Busch and New Belgium are really interested. Those brewing companies are pretty interested in incorporating organic hops into some of their brews and stuff, but there's just not a source in the United States for those.
Samantha Carlson is a second-year graduate student in landscape architecture at the University of Illinois, and somewhere along the line, her interest in hops went beyond having a cold one after some yard work. Their crazy growing habit got her attention. Hop vines can grow to be 30 feet high and can send roots down as far as 15 feet, as well as their companionability with perennial grains and perennial prairie grasses. Hop's deep rooting habit got her thinking about carbon sequestration and soil stabilization, both of which are hugely ecologically important. And she's working on ways to get some of this research out of test plots and into everyday environments. So obviously, it's not just about beer for her. Then there are the folks for whom growing hops is completely about beer. Some home brewers have become more interested in growing their own hops in recent years, thanks to a worldwide hop shortage caused by various blights and pests. This hop shortage has also been helped along by the fact that so-called super hoppy beers are extraordinarily trendy right now. Walk into your local specialty shop or even the grocery store and you'll see a zillion beers with names like Hop Stupid and Modus Hopperandi and Hopsicle. Hops add some bitter flavor to beer. It can be quite citrusy and piney and refreshing, and it's definitely delicious, but it takes a lot of hops to make those beers. It was this shortage combined with interest in localism and gardening and self-reliance that put Joan Jack and Jason Thomason on the road to adding hops to their large backyard garden in Champaign. Jason started brewing beer with a friend a couple of years ago using the hop pellets that he bought from a supplier. Joan, however, saw an opportunity.
Well, then Joan came up with the idea, my wife, well, what about growing them? So she started reading about growing hops and different kinds of hops to grow here. And so she ordered the rhizomes without even asking me. She says, we're going to grow some hops. So
I decided that we needed to grow our own hops because I had heard about the hops shortage. And I thought, you know, just to be more self-sufficient, because I like the idea of being able to provide everything for eat and drink in your own yard. So I ordered 4 rhizomes, 2 of each kind, and I planted them last spring, and this year they're just double of what they were last year. And it's been really fun watching them twine up and get really long.
This year marks the first time Joan and Jason will be harvesting and using their own hops in beer production, if the Japanese beetles don't get them first. Jason says he's in the process of figuring out what to do with the hops once they've been harvested and dried. He's not sure how much using their fresh backyard hops will matter flavor-wise either, since they've never done it before. That first batch will be an experiment. A potentially very tasty experiment.
Lisa Broth's stories can also be heard on our website, willang.org. Click on the In My Backyard link in the right navigation window. And you can read her occasional blogs at majorprogression.wordpress.com. If you have a story idea for In My Backyard, we would love to hear it. Drop us an email at willagstaff.org. That's willagstaff.org.